Okay. So welcome again. So I'll just say my name again. So I'm Subhadramati, one of the team of five of us who lead this class. One, two, three, four, five or six anyway. And so we're doing a series called Sangharajita Classics. In this class we tend to run series for 5 or 6 weeks. And this is second week. And what I thought I'd do before tea is just say a little bit about Sangharajita. Some of you will be familiar with Sangharajita and some of you might not know much or even have heard of Sangharajita, of whom the classics are, classics of. Even if you are familiar, it's always kind of worth bringing to mind this person, Sangharajita, who's the founder of the Triratna Buddhist order and community, of which we are part of. So for all the order members here, he's our teacher. So that's one of, when we became order members, that was one of the things we did more decisively, is said that we are disciples of Sangharajita. And Sangharajita is still living, so he lives in Birmingham and he's in his, coming up for his late 80s now, and he's still very much an active force to be reckoned with in our order and movement. He doesn't do very much public teaching now, but he still receives visitors, and I know a few people in this room have either just been to see him or just about to go to see him. And if anyone would like to go and see him, just ask one of the order members and we'll tell you how you can have an audience with them if you'd like to see him. So Sangharajita, as I say, he's in his mid to late 80s now. So he was born in London, and when he was 16 he realised he was a Buddhist. Upon coming across a Buddhist sutra in a second-hand bookshop, which he loved, as soon as he opened it and read it, the Diamond Sutra, he knew he was a Buddhist and he always had been. I think that feeling, or some glimpse of that feeling, may be recognisable for some of us. Quite often I hear people say, when they hear the teachings of Buddhism, of the Dharma, they feel, well, a very deep resonance. They feel, this is what I've always thought. So he felt that, presumably even more deeply, to be able to say he knew he was a Buddhist and always had been. So then he was just 16. And then it was the war. So in the war he got drafted into the army and sent to India, which was kind of a sort of lucky chance in a way. He didn't have to do any fighting. He was a signals operator. And at the end of the war, he just stayed there. He just ripped up his passport and kind of gave away everything and became a homeless wanderer in India. And then met quite significant teachers there and was taught more about Buddhism and was ordained as a monk there. And then one of his teachers said to him to stay in Kalimpong, which is in the north of India. And then that was quite fortuitous as well, because what happened there was all the Tibetan refugees were coming through, many lamas. So he met and was taught by some of the most eminent and prominent lamas. So again, he was learning all the time more and more about Buddhism and all the different schools of Buddhism. And he was very happy there. He would have been quite happy in many ways to stay there. He had a little hermitage. He did a lot of meditation, a lot of writing in those days, writing on Buddhism, and also he's really enjoys writing poetry, so some of his poems go back that time. And he would have stayed there, except he came back for a visit to England, and Jnanavacha was mentioned in this last week, so although there was Buddhism at that time in England, he found it what he called a bit armchair Buddhism. He felt that people were talking about the ideas of Buddhism, but they weren't really actually doing it. It wasn't really changing their lives. It was a bit intellectual. And kind of one thing led to another. There's a few sort of dramatic twists and turns to the story. If you want to find out more, you can read a book called The Tree Ratna Story, which is we've got out there. But anyway, he decided to stay in England, but the Buddhist society at the time didn't want him because he was, in a way, he cut quite a radical and quite an unusual figure. In India, although he really benefited from his time there, he had become a bit disillusioned with some aspects of Buddhism there, particularly the monk-lay divide that he saw that was very strongly there, and he said that sometimes he experienced that as quite hypocritical, that he felt that some of the monks, not all of them by any means, but some of the monks were just kind of onto a free meal ticket really, and some of the lay people were actually very, very strong in their practice, but they were being told, well, you can't really be the real Buddhist, it's only the monks. And he very much rebelled against that. And so when he came back to England, he still, for example, wore robes as if, you know, in the monk sort of guise, but he grew his hair all long, and he was the 60s, so he had these big sparkly rings and everything, and Afghan coats and everything. So he, like, the sort of, from what it sounds like, quite staid Buddhist at the time, like, just didn't know what to make of him. They couldn't. He was sort of uncontrollable. People who knew him at that time said he was a bit like a wild beast or something, like a wild animal that was untamable and was very unconventional, didn't follow rules. So they said, you know, you can't come in our Buddhist society. And he then did this very radical and quite audacious thing, as he said, well, you know, this means a new Buddhist movement. So he then started what was the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order at the time, and we've in the last few years changed our name to the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order. So some of the characteristics or emphasis of what's now the Tree Ratna Buddhist Order and community are one that it's neither exclusively monastic or lay. So some people within the order movement can choose to live as monks and nuns if they want to. Other people can choose to live in families and so on if they want to. Like, the life of a monk or nun isn't particularly seen as in itself more, well, it's not a sort of higher, it's not seen as a higher path in a sense. It's the principal thing is how committed one is to one's practice. So that was quite a radical, sort of departure really. And he also created an order where there was equal ordination for men and women, which again was quite a radical departure. So personally, I'm very grateful to that, to be like, so I'm in the order, I've been ordained by another woman, by a senior woman order member, was my preceptor, and then I've been able to go on and be preceptor to other women. And even today, that's quite rare in the Buddhist world for women to, well, have an equal chance to be ordained. And then once we're in the order, we're on an equal footing, as it were, to the main order members. I don't have to bow down to Nyanavata, although I might because of his just there's an equal, well, status isn't quite the right word, but I can't think of a better one for men and women. So that's another quite radical emphasis. He's also, you know, our movement also has an emphasis on the world of the arts, for example, as being, well, something that's very much encouraged as a sort of way into Buddhism, and an emphasis on spiritual friendship, an emphasis on teamwork in particular as practice. So they're just some of the things about, I just thought it might be nice, since this whole series is about Sangharaksha, it might be interesting to hear a little bit about him. And what we're doing in this series is just picking a few of his lectures that stand out. I'm already thinking we'll have to do another series because there's so many that do stand out. One of the main ways that Sangharashtra has taught has been through lectures and seminars. He has written quite a lot of books as well, but even more than the books, he's given just hundreds of lectures and seminars. The lectures, you can listen to them all on Free Buddhist Audio, which if you haven't come across, is really worth looking up on the web, Free Buddhist Audio. And the seminars you can also read there, many of them as unedited transcripts. So they're quite lengthy. If you can imagine, like, you know, there might be 2 or 3 or even a week's worth of Dharma study, every single word of which has been recorded and transcribed, and even things like long pause, you know, and laughter, you know, which in a way is quite nice because you get a sort of feeling of the whole thing. And then some of those transcripts have been turned into books like this. So this book, Wisdom Beyond Words, is by Sangharashtra, but in a way he didn't sit down with a pen and paper and write it. It's taken from the edited transcripts. And so those of us leading the team have just picked a few of what we think are our favourite lectures and just want to share them with you. And just the final thing to say before tea is, I think the fact that the lectures, it sort of, in a way, it highlights that our order and movement is a living tradition. So Sangharashtra was very much speaking to people. They weren't just writings and teachings in the abstract. He was like kind of constantly looking at, well, what's happening in the movement. Of course, it started very small, just a small band of disciples, and then it's grown and grown. So he'll have constantly been looking, things have shifted a bit much this way, it's time to bring in a bit more of this, you know, and then, you know, kind of vice versa. Like, for example, last week we had a lecture called Breaking Through to Buddhism, which, you know, really was where Sangharashtra was bringing in the need for drive and potency, and that was one of the very first lectures. You know, and just thinking in a way, well, he had encountered this armchair Buddhism, as he called it. You can imagine he was trying to inject a bit of sort of drive and vigour into things. So that lecture last week was, when was that, 1968 or something? 69. So the order was started in 67. No, the movement in 67, the order in 68. That lecture was in 69. The one we're doing tonight, which is called The Greater Mandala, was in 76, so quite a good few years later, so things have had time to start to develop. And what was happening around about 76, although the order had been going 8 or 9 years, it was still relatively small, and there was still quite all the energy was going into like building the actual institution. So people were building this place, like physically, like just spend all the time building some of our retreat centres. And in a sense, Sangharashtra was kind of catching the mood of the moment. And here's something that it says in the introduction. It said, what he was trying to do in this lecture was reasserting sort of spiritual values over getting the job done, basically. So the job needed done, the centres needed built, but I think people had got a bit sort of nose to the grindstone, sort of Protestant about it. Yeah, so Sangharashtra was kind of going, oh, you know, we'll have to, you know, he was kind of bringing in a bit of a corrective to that, to people just working so hard, I don't know what they're doing, maybe they were even forgetting to meditate or forgetting to sort of have some sense of something else, actually. Maybe I won't say more just now, we'll come back to that. But I just wanted to make the more general point that these lectures and teachings were very much to us as a community. And in a sense, he's still at it, in a way, although he's not given public public lectures and teachings, he's still very much making his thoughts known through some of his more senior disciples about, you know, what direction, you know, where have we veered too much one way and what direction do we need to go in next. So it's still very much, well, hopefully will continue to be a living tradition, our order and movement, and still at the moment, you know, Sangharaksha is very much there as a living, a literally living presence, kind of influencing that, positively influencing that. Good, so let's have tea, and then we'll come back to explore what's the meaning of the lecture, the greater mandala. Great. Okay, I think that's us all. Okay, so now we're going to explore the lecture proper, the greater mandala. And we might be writing a few things on this flip chart, I'm not quite sure, and Warren's kindly agreed to be the scribe. So, we're going to start with a word, and the word is pranya. So maybe actually, Warren, could you write up pranya? So this is a Sanskrit word. So who knows what the word pranya means?
Wisdom.
Yeah, who said that? Yes, yeah. So it means wisdom. So, well, that's a very, 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 well, I was going to say important Buddhist quality. It's kind of the quality. The perfection of wisdom is, you could say, in a sense, what makes a Buddha a Buddha. There's a more, even more precise, according to Bhante Sangharakshita, I'm saying Bhante Sangharakshita, by the way, Bhante means a revered teacher, so it's kind of got a bit of an affectionate connotation, so I'll probably say Bhante for Sangharakshita. So Bhante quotes another contemporary scholar called Guthner, Dr. Herbert Guthner, and he translates pranya even more precisely. It does mean wisdom, but according to Guthner, it's translated as analytical, appreciative understanding. So maybe you could write that up for an analytical, appreciative understanding. So on what Bhante kind of says at the beginning, roughly the beginning of this lecture, is that, okay, so the analytical bit is an essential ingredient to pranya. So we, in a way, we understand with our, well, with our intellect, with our minds. We've got to know the Dharma, know what the Dharma says. But he really draws out this appreciative bit. Bhante says, it has to be united with quite another mode of understanding, this quality of appreciativeness. So that's interesting, isn't it? Because it might not be a word that we usually associate with wisdom, the quality of appreciativeness. And here's what Bhante says to sort of expand on that. I love this bit, actually. I'd read it almost word for word. He says, the enlightenment of the Buddha was not a cold, detached knowledge. He saw with warmth, he saw with feeling. What is more, he saw everything as being pure or shubha, which also means beautiful. The Buddha saw everything as pure beauty because he saw everything with compassion. Just as conversely, when you hate someone, they appear ugly. So that's quite telling. Does that resonate with people? I know it resonated with me. Probably the when you hate somebody or something, they appear ugly. It's true, isn't it? Everything kind of gets distorted. Yeah? It's a bit like, actually, I've just thought, it's a bit like, do people know that fairy story, the Snow Queen? Do you know that? Hans Christian Andersen? Mm-hmm. And there's this mirror that shatters, and anyone who gets a shard of glass in their eye sees everything as ugly, and anyone who gets a shard of glass in their heart just feels hatred and ill will. So it's like the two of them combined. So that's when we feel hatred, we see everything, especially the objects of our hatred, as ugly. You can't believe other people see beauty in them, can you? Or see anything positive about them. But then do people experience the converse as true when you... Do you want any expansion on that or examples?
Just the converse. And if you love someone, or particularly like someone, not only might they appear are beautiful to you, but they become more beautiful. Their appearance changes for you, really.
It does, doesn't it? Yes. And I was thinking as well, sometimes people who have been on retreat ever experience that as the retreat goes on, people look more and more beautiful. Yeah, which I think is probably actually happening because as we, but also it's both objective and subjective, isn't it? As we get more and more positive, we see the beauty in people. So that's quite interesting. That's Bhante trying to draw that out. And then he says, when out of metta you see things as beautiful, you naturally experience joy and delight. And out of that joy and delight flow spontaneity, freedom, creativity and energy. This flow from metta to joy to freedom and energy is the constant experience of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva's wisdom in the fullest sense therefore includes metta. In a sense, we could even say that metta is pranya. So that's quite strong what he's saying. He's saying not only does wisdom include metta for the Bodhisattva, so the Bodhisattva is a being who's bent on enlightenment for all beings, so it's the highest ideal in Buddhism. So not only does wisdom include metta, but we could even say that metta is pranya, that metta is wisdom. So how is that then? How is metta actually wisdom? So if wisdom's the sort of pinnacle, the highest, but here Bhante say that's actually equivalent to metta.
So is he wise enough to see through the delusion? Uh-huh. You sort of see things as they really are.
Uh-huh. Yes. And how are things really?
Well, usually it's just all the conditioning and everything that we put on top of things that make life difficult.
Yeah. I think that's getting at it, isn't it? It's how we usually see things is strongly biased by our own greed, hatred and delusion. So when we see people, we see them as ugly because of our hatred, for example. So if you... What metta and the practice of the metta bhavana in its fullest sense is working towards completely removing those biases. So it's kind of coming at it. It's like the understanding follows the action. You can come at it both way around. That if you had full understanding, you would just feel metta. Yeah. So if wisdom arose, you would naturally feel compassion. And you can approach it the other way around. If you cultivate metta, true metta, then that would be the same as wisdom, because you'd no longer be biased by your own sense of I. You wouldn't be thinking, well, that person isn't getting metta because I don't like them, which is very much what we do, isn't it? That's the selfish response. But if we could see, well, even though I don't like them in a sense, they're still, they're still deserving. Just by their very being, everyone deserves metta in a way. It's removing that sense of I as the great kind of giver out of who gets metta and who doesn't, which we often, I must say I often do. Yeah. So that's quite a strong beginning, isn't it? So Bhante goes on to say that another word that is kind of connected with pranya is the word vidya. Do you want to have a go at writing up vidya? Do you know how to spell it?
D-Y-A.
D-Y-A, yeah. Does anybody know what the word vidya means? Anybody know what avidya means? That's a little test, because we've done that in a class before, avidya.
Absence of vigour.
Yeah, it does mean absence. Very good, it does. It means absence of vigour. No, just caution to him. It means, yeah. And so avidya means ignorance, yeah, which is indeed absence of vidya. The a prefix means absence. So ignorance in the sense of a sort of willful ignorance. So you could say that vidya was the absence of ignorance, which you could say was knowledge, for example. But again, Guthner translates it more precisely, and Bhante says more to its, nearer to its true meaning as aesthetic appreciation. So again, you've got this quality of appreciation. Bhante says a sort of relishing of things, a harmony with the world. And he said the opposite, avidya, can space a sense of alienation and conflict. So it's not knowledge in the usual sense of just the something that we know with our brain. Avidya is alienation and conflict. Vidya is harmony and appreciation. It's quite good sometimes learning these Sanskrit words. I often think that we can use them as an extension of our vocabulary because they don't exactly translate into English. And sometimes that's often, you know, our order names are a bit of a mouthful for some people, but our order names are made up of these words. So at the centre, for example, you might have met Vidyadaka. So the Vidya in his name means he's another one of the teachers here. Or you might have met Pranya Devi, who teaches on a Thursday night. So her name is not Pranya. Question, Holly?
Can you say more about why appreciation might be a sort of knowledge? I'm not.
Yeah, okay. Anybody got any?
Because to me it's something you'd appreciate after you knew if you said one comes before the other.
Well, in a way, I think what he's trying to say is knowledge isn't really a good enough translation. I think that's what he's trying to get at, that the translation as knowledge isn't really adequate in the first place.
So is it like seeing things as they are?
Yeah.
Is there clarity of...
Yeah. I think so, yeah.
I can kind of get it a bit semantic, like you might say, I appreciate that if someone tells you something, or I get it.
Yeah.
It's something more fundamental. If I
yeah.
I can learn something,
yeah.
I can learn it kind of like by right.
Yeah.
If I get it, I can kind of feel the knowledge.
Yeah.
It's kind of something's falling into place. Maybe
yeah.
It's something like that.
Yeah, maybe it's an actually. I've just realised actually he goes on to say a bit more about this, so maybe. But I think that's what is it. I think it's a good question. So here's what Bhante says. This has just saved me. I can just read what Bhante says. So what Bhante says, he says often when we say we know something, there's a suggestion that the knowledge is utilitarian. So he says, for example, we know what's good for us. We know what we can do with something. We know what something's for. And he gives us an example from his own life. He says that he was out for a walk when he was still living in Kalimpong, and he saw this huge, beautiful pine tree. And Bhante was standing admiring it. And a Nepali friend came along, and Bhante says, "Oh, just look at this tree. Isn't it magnificent?" And the friend says, "Oh yes, there must be at least 20 monds of firewood there, enough for the whole winter." I don't know what a mond is, it must be a large amount. So I think what he's getting at is the word knowing can have that a bit of a utilitarian sort of sense to it. And he's trying to get to something that's much more than utilitarian. So he goes on to say, if we see the utilitarian value of something, we relate to it from a need which becomes a desire, which turns into craving for the object conceived of fulfilling that desire. So a bit like, for those of us who were here last week, we talked about when does a desire become neurotic, didn't we? And I think that's when it's got that utilitarian. So the tree is seen not as existing in its own right for its own sake, but as something to fulfil our need. But if we haven't got desires to be fulfilled, then in a sense there's no subject and object, because then it's that desire that creates me as a subject, and the object will give me something, and that's how I know it. I know it as simply in its sense of, well, what's it good for? So again, Bhante says that would be the state of the bodhisattva, empty of any desire to use things for a particular purpose. So all that would be left would be aesthetic appreciation. Anything? Yeah, Sarah?
Is he saying there that, is he using the word utilitarian as a substitute for, or as an equivalent for objective? So like, and is this based on the premise that everything that we think is knowledge, or things that we know or learn or gain wisdom in, are actually just our own perceptions and interpretations and very subjective? And that's the reality. There's no reality out there. And so if it's all about us and what's in our mind and the constructions that we make in our mind to mean our interpretation of what is reality or wisdom or truth or whatever, that's actually, that can be equated with metta. It can come from metta.
So I just lost you a little bit at that last bit. So.
I'm not really sure what I mean, but I think that the knowledge, or is he trying to say that wisdom is our own construct? There's no objective wisdom out there that anyone can touch and point to. It's all our interpretation. And so it all comes from us and how we see things. And so that's what determines how we perceive wisdom. And so it's all about, it can be metta coming from us, which is equated to wisdom. Is that what
I think he's, let me see if I understand. I think in a sense it's not that we perceive wisdom. Wisdom's more like how we perceive. So if we're looking at the world, well, again, with that example of the tree, of what I can get from the tree, then that's what he's saying is utilitarian, because it's our seeing of the tree is kind of tainted, as it were, by our own kind of needs and wants from the tree. But whereas if we can just see it as, if we just let it be a tree, then that would be seeing it more as it really is. And there would be a natural sense of enjoyment. We wouldn't be sort of, quite often even with beautiful things, we grab them a little bit. We think, oh, I must like tell my friend about this, or paint it, or take a photograph. But every now and then you just have that experience where you can just let it be it. And then just quite naturally there arises a sort of the joy of that, and a sort of freedom in that. And that's more like the nature of wisdom would have more of that sense, because you're that starting, that's a taste of seeing things as they are, i.e. untainted by our greed, hatred and delusion. So that's what I think he's getting at.
That also reminds me of the singing of Adult Chiris awareness.
The voice, what's there, Ben? I don't hear you.
That also reminds me of a scene in the film La Dolce Vita, where there are all these television crews and some young children say they've seen a religious vision.
Uh-huh.
And this big enthusiastic crowd, they kind of run to the spot where the figures were seen, and they tear down these trees and they want to grab a kind of a piece of twig to take home.
Yeah.
And what, in a sense, what the film seems to be criticising is not so much even the whole question of the children and the visions, but the fact that they kind of want to grab a bit. And it's just very powerful, the image of these real living trees that are completely devastated by a hysterical crowd.
Yeah. Well, I haven't seen the film, but that sounds like it. It sounds like that's illustrating our tendency to want to grab, and make it a part of me somehow, appropriate it to ourselves. And he does go into this more in the lecture, but it started, in a way, we shouldn't really blame ourselves for that, because it's kind of part of our survival mechanism that we've had to learn to do that. I mean, we do, in a sense, that person did need the firewood. So it's not a kind of blaming thing, but we need to, what we'll start exploring in a minute is how do we undo that in a sort of positive way. Yeah. Shall I go on a little bit? So he goes on to say, so all that's left is aesthetic appreciation. So he says, if you're a bodhisattva, you enjoy the world as much as you enjoy a work of art. Which again, I think that ties in with it. There's just that enjoyment. So, but then immediately, as soon as you think, because I don't know if you're like me, you think, oh, well, that's all very well for bodhisattvas, you know. The rest of us have got, like, work to do, you know. The rest of us have got, you know, families to feed or, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, I don't know if other people are immediately feeling that, you know. We can't just swan around, like, looking at the world as a work of art. So he says... The purpose of a bodhisattva, if one may speak in that way at all, is in no degree passive, however. And he says, it's not unlike the function of the artist, except that the painter, say, can really just enjoy the world without starting to think of how to make a picture out of it. Because even with our artistic things, we can sometimes be a bit like that, can't we? He says, what the bodhisattva creates is something quite different. He says, the bodhisattva quite unpurposefully rearranges the whole universe and turns it into a gigantic mandala. So then we've got this word mandala. So what does this mean? So he says, what is a mandala? So what is a mandala? So does anybody want to have a stab at it? It's kind of entered our vocabulary, that word, hasn't it? The word mandala. But, Warren... So what is a mandala? When have we encountered it?
It's a symmetrical shape, uh-huh. Which is balanced.
Yeah.
We have, for example, a square inside a circle. It has a blend of colours, and the colours have particular symbolisms.
Uh-huh.
It might represent an ideal palace. Or a place, an ideal place, I think.
Uh-huh, great. So that's a pretty good description. So it's something symmetrical, it's a harmonious design with a balance of colours and shapes. And yes, and it's definitely got symmetry. And it's something about an ideal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, anybody else got anything to add to that? Yes?
A visual map.
A visual mantra, so that's interesting. So how would you...
Because a lot is about the meditation.
Sorry, Claire?
What I've heard described is the finished mandala. Ah. Is the whole doing of it.
That's okay.
Like focusing on repetition.
Okay. So it's something that's essentially creative. It's
and helpful.
Okay, yeah, and helpful, yeah. Yes?
Something of value surrounded by something beautiful.
Oh, the textbook answer from Nigel.
That was your definition of Sifu.
Okay, was it? Well, good memory then. Yeah. Well, that came from Bhante's definition, which actually what everyone said is part of the definition. So the more... The simplest definition that Bhante gives from a Tibetan teacher, and he says, this Tibetan teacher called Rongzompa Chogyi Zangpo says, to make a mandala is to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. So to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. Yeah, so often at the centre of a mandala is a figure of a Buddha. For Buddhists, it would often be a figure of a Buddha at the centre. and then this harmonious, dynamic, balanced pattern round about him. So what's been said here is that the Bodhisattva creates, what was it, rearranges the whole universe and turns it into a gigantic mandala. So what does that mean? So Banji says that this happens because the Bodhisattva's response to the world is aesthetic and appreciative rather than utilitarian. And he says that to sustain life you have to engage in a certain amount of practical activity. You have to think about things and understand how the world works. But if you're a Bodhisattva, all this takes place within an overall context of aesthetic appreciation. He says, we usually think of aesthetic appreciation as a little separate part of life within a much larger area that's utilitarian and practical. We do that, don't we? We've got our life and we think, oh, I need some culture, I'll go to a gallery, or I might read a poem every morning. You know, so that becomes a little corner. Is that true of most of us? Even that sometimes can be an achievement, can't it? So does that sort of ring true, that often the larger experience is utilitarian and we might put a little injection of aesthetic value in? Yeah. But here he's saying something. He's saying that really it needs to be the other way around. Our overall attitude, our overall response to life should be purely aesthetic. We should not seek to use things, but just enjoy them, appreciate them, feel for them. He says we don't need to think of our mandala of aesthetic appreciation just like a little sort of picture on the wall, as it were, sitting in a corner of the great big real world of important practical business. Instead, we can think of ourselves as living within a greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation, of which all our practical mundane affairs and the fulfillment of all our non-neurotic needs and wants occupy just a tiny corner. The real values are aesthetic and not utilitarian. So what do you think of that? The real values are aesthetic, not utilitarian. Is this an impossible, has he given us an impossible task?
It's a nice idea.
Yeah, but it's
very practical for life.
Yeah.
Try saying that to EDF energy.
Is that a sort of general response? Nice idea, but...
Well, in principle, do the things you have to do and look at them in a different way.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, I think it's impossible to sort of give up every utilitarian thing that we do. But you can do them differently.
Okay. So I think this might be the key, might it? And have you ever had experience of that?
I suppose sometimes, cycling to work, you just think, well, it comes to 40-minute cycle and I've got to get there. But if you just slow down and sometimes, cycle through Victoria Park, and sometimes it's just beautiful. I cannot think, and 10 minutes have gone by because I'm looking at the trees. Looking at the other people, and you don't really think about the thing you have to do.
You're
sort of looking at
I think that really is the key, isn't it? It's our attitude to the things we do that change it. And what helps us, and what supports that?
When you're not in a hurry.
When you're not in a hurry.
I think that other people might be doing the same thing. Because often, if I'm on the way to work and I'm running late, I just think all my boss is concerned about is the fact that I'm late. And yet, my boss might be walking through the park as well.
That's very good. So using your imagination to realise that actually what you value, other people might value as well. That's how I like that. That's good. I haven't quite thought about that, but that's true. Why shouldn't our boss also like looking at the blue sky and the flowers or whatever?
I also think that along with aesthetic beauty or wisdom, metta, comes things like health and friendship and love, and they're anti-utilitarian as well. So in a way, the things that are really, really important, there's no price on it, or there's no can't work to get these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
And most works of art are spun out of nothing. They're made, they're manifest, and I kind of think you can't live without love or beauty or health and friendships.
Yeah.
And they're not utilitarian at all, and they're incredibly valuable.
Yeah. So that's
not buy these things.
Yeah. And it's like it's putting our appreciating those more some things that sometimes we even take for granted. Should I read a little bit more of what he says? Because I think the things we're saying, he's unfolding more and more in this lecture. So, and again, this also kind of addresses, I think, maybe some fears about, well, what about the fact we've got to actually get on with life? So Banti says, I'm not talking about some lotus-eating, daydreaming, navel-gazing ideal. That the bodhisattva is, in fact, the greatest worker of all, constantly responding to the objective needs of a situation. But at the same time, he or she, the bodhisattva that is, operates within the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation. So it's not even as though the sphere in which the bodhisattva operates is a sort of separate sphere of practical activity over here. It's like they're never out of the sphere of aesthetic appreciation. So that what you described as that experience we can have sometimes, it's just all we need to do is imagine our whole life could be like that, and everything could take place within that. So we wouldn't. It's not like we suddenly need to stop going to work, or stop looking after our families or something. But we can. We try and learn more and more to do it within that sphere of appreciation, and we do that by getting more and more in touch with the values of that sphere. I think, like you said, the values of beauty, for example. So we are usually not like that, though, are we? I mean, we have glimpses of it, which is great, but we're usually swinging between two poles. This is what Banti says. And we still got room on that page. We can turn the page over if you like them. So Banti says we're usually at one or other extreme. Like, on one hand, he says, we're so immersed in the practical activities that we identify with them. What happens when we identify with the practical activities? What happens to our own mental state? What we like when we're over-identified with a practical activity? Anybody ever do that? Over
anxious,
yeah. Anything else?
A bit less sort of embodied, you know,
you're
not right up into your head.
Yeah. And what do we look like to other people?
Robots,
yeah, we do, don't we? Yeah. Harassed, we often look harassed, don't we? Harassed and worried. Yeah. And somehow we're sort of narrow, aren't we? We're definitely not looking at the blue sky and the flowers as we cycle along. We're kind of very kind of overly focused in, gotta go to work, gotta get these emails done, you know, so we've lost perspective. So that's one pole. Do people recognise getting into that state? Yeah. So that's one pole. And then he says the other pole is we can lose ourselves in a sort of spaced out, maybe vaguely positive, but on the other hand, but it's quite spaced out and we can't get anything done. Him to get into that sort of state, it's a bit spaced out, can't get anything done. Does one feel more prominent than the other? I mean, I identify more with the harassed and worried, but is that generally true? Or does the spaced out happen quite a lot as well?
Then the swing between those, as you say, work and leisure.
Yeah.
It can be that kind of like that vegetative state into either TV or computer or kind of like can't really function in any creative way.
Yeah.
There's no energy.
Yeah.
So it's like a fish that's clenched and at work, and then you get tired and you kind of collapse.
Yeah.
You don't have anything. And you're wound up again, so you just go back and forth.
Yeah.
There's no relaxed.
Yeah.
Energized state.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really good way of putting it. We do ricochet, and actually I was thinking that myself. I was talking to a friend, and she was talking about giving up smoking, and actually she's not a sort of chain smoker or anything. She says she has a cigarette every few weeks or something, and we were talking about that. Why? You were saying, why do you do that? And I thought, for my equivalent of that is like, sort of reading novels too late at night, and we realised we both did it because we felt like we sort of deserved a reward, like we'd done all this hard work, just teaching at the centre and everything, and then you kind of think, oh yeah, now I need a reward from that. So there's a sort of ricochet between a sort of clenched fist mode of operating that then you tell yourself, oh, I need something, a reward, but the thing you do as a reward doesn't really energise you or properly nourish you. And we were thinking, oh, wouldn't it be good to have a more, if one was living more in that greater mandala, you wouldn't have those abrupt shifts of, or those ricochets, so do people recognise that sort of ricocheting from one to the other? I think Sam described it really well, actually. You don't
really see that in children.
Yeah, interesting. So there's a more, and the characteristic of children is being more playful, isn't it? Yeah. Although they do get upset over games and stuff, don't they, as well? So it's interesting. So it's much more a middle way. So that's definitely what Bante is advocating, is trying to find a middle way between those extremes. And I'm sure we would all agree that that would make sense. So if people heard that term, the middle way, before, it's used. Mm-hmm. What does it actually mean, the middle way? Who can give us a good definition of the middle way?
I think I've heard someone say, like, not too tight, not too loose.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So exactly that, you're not like gritted teeth, like, here we go, and you're getting like this.
Yeah.
It's like I don't know if anyone's ever tried to be creative when you're either, in one of these tips that you describe, when you're feeling too lazy, so you literally can't pick your pen up.
Yeah.
Or you're feeling too tense, like I went to art college.
Yeah.
And one thing I learned quite quickly was you can't create by concentrating really, really hard and staring at a piece of paper until your eye moves. Need that playful edge.
Yeah. And I think you've described it well, because I think the middle way, the true middle way, kind of capital M, capital W, is essentially creative. So it's not just a halfway. It's not just that you're halfway in between the kind of tense, kind of got to get it done, and the kind of blobbed out. It's not that you're sort of about half of one and half of the other. It's something over and above the two that's creative. So that's what the middle way is often talked about, being between extremes, but it's not really between us and just in the middle. It's between us and the third point of a triangle. It's over and above the poles. So what we're trying to do, what the Bodhisattva would have done, is found a true middle way. But that's not easy to achieve, So in the meantime, we're probably going to have to recognise how to work with the extremes. So what do you think might be a good antidote to that extreme of, got to get the job done, and all that? What do you think? What can we do that gives us a sort of antidote to that?
Question, why are you thinking that you need to get the job done right now?
You could bring in reflection,
It's mindfulness,
yeah.
Being less goal-orientated and enjoying the
Yeah, 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 yeah. So all of them are definitely true. So we're trying to be more mindful. We're trying to have more reflection and be less goal-oriented. What practical thing can we do? Something we talk about quite a lot in this class that might help to just get us into that different mode.
Meditate.
Meditate and go on retreat. Yeah, go on retreat, yeah. So, yeah, which we're often talking about. I think sometimes going on retreat can get us, because I think these answers people have said are good, but I know when I'm in that mode, I find it quite hard to even reflect my way out of it, because I'm convinced that actually the job really does need done and it's life or death, and it's almost I need sometimes to physically step out. And like going on retreat can just by that change of environment, being in the countryside, you know, not having my computer, you know, or my phone can get me out of it. So I think if we can, going on retreat can be a good antidote. But yes, coming to the class, meditating. It's quite good being on the team actually, because you've kind of, in a sense, you've kind of got to come, you've committed to come. And that can get out of the mode of, you know, I've got to get these tasks done.
Trying to treat it as an art form.
What's that?
Trying to treat it as an art form.
Yeah, trying to
treat. The art of living rather
than the art. Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we're trying. That's definitely what we're trying to do. And I think there's some practical things. I think that's. I love the way of describing it. And that going on retreat, I would say, is quite a good practical way of helping us to do that. What about the other extreme, those of us that tend to get a bit spaced out? What can help with that? Yeah.
I'd say get active.
Yeah, get active, yeah. And particularly like looking for a project, I think that can really, sometimes having something that's bigger than ourselves can just draw us out, can't it? I mean, sometimes life presents us with that. Like I've heard people say sometimes like having children, it kind of, it gets you out of it, doesn't it? And in the absence of that, you know, actively seeking something out that you've, in a way you've said you'll do it, so you're going to keep your word and do it. And then you can that can generate more energy, can't it? So there's just a couple of like quite practical things we can do, and everything everybody said I think is useful actually. So I want to kind of race on a bit. The time almost seems to go a bit quicker than I think, because I do want to introduce us to this figure as well. So Banti says it's like trying to have both almost alternate. An ideal life would have both periods of really getting away from it all, where we've got no responsibilities. That's why on retreat we're always saying things like, don't bring your mobile phone, turn your phone off, so that you're not on that mode of somebody can make demands of you. I think mobile phones particularly, and the whole technological stuff we've had in the last few years, mean that we're often in that slight, well, anybody can get me at any time. We need to have times where nobody can make a demand on us. We're not answerable or responsible. We can just be, as it were, just be ourselves. So we need times like that. And then we need projects that are sort of worthwhile to really engage our energies with. So we need both. You know, we need to kind of know our own tendencies and think, well, where do I need more of one than the other? I mean, on the whole, I think probably a lot of us, because we do live in the city, probably, maybe, I dare to suggest, need to learn to do nothing, the do nothing one a bit more. And Banti gives this funny little example of a Buddhist nun he once knew who was, you know, very high powered, and he said she had a terrible temper, she was very demanding and exacting, she was always busy, she'd always be washing and scrubbing and, what does he say, feeding her dogs and cats, cooking and studying at the same time, writing letters, building things, knocking them down, she never stopped, you know, he said. And she came to Banti and says, Banti, I just can't seem to meditate, what shall I do? And he said, you know, he said, well, you're very good in many ways, but there's just one thing you've got to learn, and then you'll be able to meditate. And she said, what is it, what is it? You know, you get ready with her to rush out and do it, to write it down. And he said, you must learn to waste time. And he said, at this she nearly jumped out of her robe and said, waste time, but there's so many things to be done. You know, that's not Buddhism. And I think she ran off and was never heard from again. And apparently, unfortunately, she never did learn to waste time. So that can be quite a practice, just learn to waste time, even for 10 minutes a day. Just perhaps do nothing for 10 minutes a day, and that can be quite challenging for some of us. So the bodhisattva does do useful things, but he or she enjoys them, and I think that's back to your, you know, the whole question of attitude. And this is why it's said that the bodhisattva plays. So the idea of lila, as in Lilamani's name, or play of the bodhisattva, it's the purely spontaneous welling up of spiritual energy that's in a way purposeless. So that's quite a lovely idea, isn't it? And Bhante goes on to say, and I think this ties in with your point, is the difference between work and play is, well, what is the difference between work and play? How would you define the difference between work and play?
Get paid for one.
Yeah, you get paid for one. Yeah, yeah. If you got paid to play, yes.
I think you can get paid to play.
Yeah.
In some
yeah, yeah, sometimes you can, can't you?
So I think it's work is when it's something that's sort of a bit more serious, something that really matters.
Yeah.
Whereas with play, sort of, you've got a bit more room
to
try around
and mess up. Yeah, I think that's good. So often we get paid for work, although sometimes we get paid for play, or sometimes you could even say we play and get paid for it. And in play we get allowed to mess up. So Bhante says the difference between work and play is not necessary. It's not harnessed to any goal. It serves no purpose. You can live without the arts, he says. No one ever dropped dead from lack of art. It's quite superfluous, but that's why it's so necessary. So that's interesting, isn't it? So, like you said about love and about beauty, we're not going to, in one way, we're not going to die without them, but another way, we are going to die without them.
A baby would die if it wasn't shown love.
Yeah.
It's like a food group.
Yeah.
A baby wouldn't thrive.
Yeah. So that's interesting, but I suppose a baby might not...
Wouldn't actually die.
So, and I think that's quite the interesting distinction, isn't it? So the bodhisattva's life is lovely because it's the useless life. So this greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation has also been glossed, the greater mandala of uselessness. But that's meant in the most positive sense, yeah? So all that meditation and study and right livelihood culminates in the experience of being happy just being yourself with nothing particular to do. You might just be dancing around the room, aimlessly, unself-consciously, not trying to be playful or spontaneous, but just being yourself. Some busybody, Bhante says, will then turn up and say, come on, what are you wasting your time like that for? There's work to be get on with. But Bhante says that's putting the cart before the horse, or rather harnessing the horse to the cart. And he says something, like I think quite profound here, although this all feels quite kind of light and quite lovely. He says, consider this, he says. Well, he says often we feel like we've got to justify our existence basically by having some sort of talent to give to the world. He says, but consider this: even if we feel we've got no talents at all, he says, this apparently useless human being is a product of millions upon millions of years of evolution. You are the goal. You are what it's all been for. You don't have to justify your existence by being useful. you yourself are the justification of your existence. I often feel I should read that every morning. You know, we don't have to prove ourselves, because I think often that kind of doing, and somehow we're trying to make ourselves worthy of being on the planet. Somewhere we think we don't deserve to be alive if we're not doing something. It's very kind of, it's the Protestant work ethic thing, isn't it? But here we're saying, Bhante's saying, you are an end in yourself. Yeah? He says, all you can really be said to be here for is to develop, is to become a bodhisattva. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you don't do all these tasks, actually. You're here to develop metta, to grow and develop. He says it's a virtue to be ornamental as well as useful. And he gives a little warning here. He says if you take this seriously, you have to be watchful for people trying to work on your feelings of guilt. Yeah? So if someone starts saying to you, look how hard I'm working for the Dharma, don't you feel bad just sitting there doing nothing, let me do it all. You should say, no, I feel fine. I'm just enjoying watching you do it. So that's interesting. Again, he's making quite a serious point, I think. He says it's important not to give in to that sort of emotional arm twisting. He says if somebody's trying to twist your arm like that, they are being highly unskillful, appealing to negative emotions to get things done, instead of arousing enthusiasm to work for the joy of it. He says, don't take even your Buddhist activities too earnestly. You can sort of imagine him giving this lecture and the people trying to build the centre and stuff like that. We're going, oh my God, don't say that, but you know, we'll never get the centre built. But he says, interestingly, he's always kind of balanced, Bhante. He says, I'm not advocating irresponsible frivolity or frittering away of energy in unmindful hilarity. He says, but even when you're trying to do your best to succeed, remember that you're essentially at play and you don't lose sleep over a game. It isn't worth it. Being serious doesn't mean being solemn. So he says, the bodhisattva's resolved this sort of seeming opposition or antithesis between aesthetic contemplation on one hand and practical activity on the other. And we are still working with that, presumably. We are still working with these poems. He says all we can do is somehow try to carry on aesthetic experience into the practical activity. And he says we can make a start by adopting a more light-hearted attitude towards practical things. He says, by all means be useful, but only within the much larger context of complete uselessness. And he says, Taoism is quite good on this whole theme. He says, Taoists say that the man of Tao is like a great tree which is so big that it's good for nothing. The branches are too thick for making axe handles and so on. So he says one should try to be too big to be useful. I like that. And I wanted to finish by just describing this figure on the shrine, then we'll finish with the mantra. Does anybody know who the figure on the shrine is? Ratnasambhava. So I think Ratnasambhava is too big to be useful. So Ratnasambhava is the jewel-born one. His realm is the glorious. So he's a very glorious figure. He's very splendid. His time of day is the noonday sun. So he's right out there and then nothing to hide, as it were. Just happy to be resplendent in his glory. He's golden yellow, as we can see. And he's the Buddha of beauty. Because again, that's our, you know, what we're talking about here is an aesthetic response to the world. And it's like Ratnasambhava is just reveling in that. He's the Buddha of beauty, he's the Buddha of abundance. And he's the Buddha of encouragement. He's encouraging us all to grow into as big as we can be. Ratnasambhava wouldn't be sort of telling us off because we hadn't got all our emails finished or anything like that. He's encouraging us to grow into to be too big to be useful. He's the sort of antithesis of a utilitarian approach to life. So that's a little bit about him. Of course, you can read much more about Ratnasambhava in many texts by Bhante and other teachers. You can read this whole lecture in this book, Wisdom Beyond Words. It's also in a book called The Essential Sangharashtra with all his teachings. And you can listen to it on Free Buddhist Audio. So I felt like that was a bit of a race through that lecture as ever, but I do. I often think sometimes I should just read that lecture every day before starting work, and I'd have quite a different approach to my day. So let's end the evening. We've still got 5 minutes, hooray, by chanting the mantra of Ratnasambhava, which Dayabhadra is going to lead us in. And while we chant this, perhaps we can think about being too big to be useful. Yep. So we can settle into our meditation postures. And if you like, while the mantra is going on, if you'd like to offer a stick of incense, feel free. And you could imagine yourself in making that offering, sort of dedicating yourself to the life of beauty and aesthetic appreciation. We'll just take a moment to settle then, when Dayabhadra feels the time's right.
Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. 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 Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om Ratnasambhava Trayam. Ratnasambhava Trayam. Om 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 Ratnasambhava Trayam.
This evening, so hope to see you next week for the next in our series. Thank you.
Thank you.